You're listening to Unlimited Hangout. I'm your host, Whitney Webb. Though measures implemented in schools and the workplace early last year were then justified as emergency and temporary measures, this quickly gave way to assertions that such measures were here to stay as part of the new normal that would emerge in the post-COVID era. Even though many of the initial justifications for these measures have since been challenged by actual data or no longer relevant, we continue to be told that many of these changes from the past year and a half or so are now permanent and we must accept them without debate or further scrutiny. The new normal is being applied to nearly every sector of the economy and daily life, but the way it's being applied in the field of education is particularly worthy of our attention, as these policies will undoubtedly shape future generations whose physical and mental health and well-being have already taken a hit during the course of the COVID crisis. We are being told that remote learning and high-tech learning tools that replace in-person instruction are here to stay, while discussion of the effects of quarantines, distancing, and isolation on the development and well-being of children and teens are largely absent from the discussion. Those demanding these policies not only remain but be expanded are, in many cases, the very bodies that are supposed to represent the best interests of students and education professionals. While they have cloaked their claims as being motivated by public health concerns, the evidence points to that not being the case and instead suggests that ulterior motives provoked by the near complete corporate takeover of the American education system are to blame. Joining me today to discuss these underreported issues is John Klesek. John is a college professor whose scholarship focuses on the history of the eugenics movement, particularly the Huxley family, as well as Aldous Huxley's dystopian novel Brave New World. He is the author of the book School World Order, The Technocratic Globalization of Corporatized Education, and is also a contributor to several publications, including Unlimited Hangout, where he has published three articles this year exploring the conflicts of interest between big tech, the U.S. education system, teachers' unions, and globalist oligarchs and their institutions. His most recent piece for Unlimited Hangout was published last week and covers the efforts of the U.S.'s largest teachers' union to sell out teachers and students in favor of edtech corporations and UNESCO. I'm very happy to have you on the program, John. How's it going?
It's going very good. It is my great pleasure and honor to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. So to start off, a lot of your recent work for Unlimited Hangout anyway has touched on how certain groups, particularly teachers' unions, have been utilizing measures introduced early on during the COVID crisis, like remote learning, social distancing, and so on, and to push for the permanence of these measures, even while the supposed public health justifications have since evaporated. So could you lay out some of the evidence that has emerged over the past year or so that these measures actually do little, if anything, to halt the spread of disease, and how the country's biggest teachers' unions are ignoring both this and the damage that these remote learning measures have done to students?
Sure, yeah. So as far as the ineffectiveness of the social distancing policies and the masking policies and things like that, there's several studies that have shown, first of all, that in-person schooling does not increase community transmission. Then, of course, you have the fact that school-age students are not highly susceptible to COVID. And I believe that the total number of COVID deaths to date, and that's more than 1 year's worth, right? Because they've rolled the numbers over. They didn't just start over again the next year and you know, go year for year to tabulate. But the total number of youth deaths, school age deaths of COVID is underneath what it what the flu typically does. And then, of course, you also have the social distancing policies, which in different countries have been at different distances, right? And so, like, you know, science doesn't work that way, right? Like, if the virus empirically has been studied to travel through aerosols, 6 feet, 3 feet, whatever it is, then that's what it is. You can't say that now, as the NEA, National Education Association, lobbied the CDC to roll back their social distancing policies. The CDC earlier this year, they wanted to reduce the social distancing from 6 foot to 3 foot. in order to reopen schools, which, right, regardless of whether or not there was less virus sort of being spread around at the time, it still travels the same distance. And so the fact that the NEA wanted them to increase that distance back to 6 foot, what that would effectively do is it would force at least hybrid style learning or blended learning. And that is where, so there's distance learning, which is where everything is remote and the students are at home and the teachers are at home and all the learning is transmitted through video conferencing and other learning management software. If we were to go to the 3 foot distancing that the CDC basically arbitrarily was going to allow, that should be enough space to enable you to fit a student in every desk, right? But if you go 6 feet, now you have to basically stagger the desks to keep the students 6 feet apart, which means you can only have half a classroom filled. And that would be the hybrid or blended learning. So blended would be where you're in the classroom, but you're on a device the whole time, and the teacher is basically a facilitator of the modules on the electronic device. The hybrid would be where half the class is in person on 3 days a week, and the other half is doing the distance learning. Then it would alternate for the 2 days in the middle, where the other students come to the classroom, and the students that were previously in the classroom, they go home to distance learning. And then the next week, you would stagger the 3 days and the 2 days. You would alternate that between the two groups. And so what it essentially does is it forces schools to continue to use these ed tech devices and platforms, which are facilitated through public-private partnerships with big technology corporations. And so what I saw in the ploy of the NEA and also the AFT, American Federation of Teachers, their goal in their ulterior motive, in my analysis, of lobbying the CDC to make its school reopening policies more strict was to basically wedge in the continuation of these big tech public-private partnerships.
Well, regarding the distancing thing that you just mentioned and the 3 feet, 6 feet debate, it is worth noting that I think just not that long ago, I think it was in mid-September, this former FDA commissioner, Scott Gottlieb, who a lot of people have also noted that he's on the board of Pfizer since having left the FDA. Anyway, he went on mainstream news, I think it was Face the Nation, and he essentially came out and said that the CDC's a 6 foot rule was just completely arbitrary, arbitrary being his word, and that no one knows where it came from. The decision to use 6 feet, it was just something decided on essentially by bureaucrats and not actually based on data. And like you were saying, it's not like the NEA really provided any scientific evidence to justify 6 versus 3 feet and their efforts to lobby therein. And as you point out, it has the obvious effect of forcing a particular learning system upon schools, in favor of, institutionalizing at least a partial remote learning, if not entire remote learning, depending on I guess the whims of the school board and in a particular area. So let's talk a little more about some of these ulterior motives here. So you have detailed this pretty extensively in some of your recent reports, but if you could just summarize maybe, or really just go into as much detail as you feel like, I guess. So what are the main conflicts of interest of these teacher unions, and how are they acting more like lobbying groups for private ed tech corporations instead of doing what they're supposed to do, which is representing the collective voice of teachers?
So let's start with the history of the National Education Association's development of education technologies. And we can go back to at least the 1960s when they had a project that was through their Department of Audiovisual Instructions. And it was called teaching machines and programmed instruction. That was related to, they all had a project called Educational Implications of Automation. And the that project was funded with an unrestricted grant from IBM. Okay, and then that same year, they came out with that source book called Teaching Machines and Programmed Instruction. In that book, it was edited by two rock stars in behavioral psychology and programmed instruction, which were the early, what they called teaching machines. And those were the prototypical adaptive learning software, what is now known as adaptive learning software, that were developed by behavioral psychologist B.F. Skinner. So the two editors of the document, there was Arthur A. Lumsdaine, and he conducted social psychology research on World War II soldiers. In particular, he wanted to test various attitudes for, quote, worldwide importance. And then his partner in editing this project was Robert Glaser. And Robert Glaser, not only was he a behavioral psychologist himself, but he also worked in theories of programmed instruction. He was given the E.L. Thorndike Award and the James McKean Cattell Award. Those two individuals were some of the precursors to the behavioral stimulus response psychology that B.F. Skinner would later develop into operant conditioning. So all this stuff goes back to Wilhelm Wundt in Leipzig, Germany, back in the 1800s. G. Stanley Hall would become the first professor of behavioral psychology in the United States. So after he went and learned under Wundt, and Wundt is the world's first psychology laboratory, Hall sets up his own in the United States. And then hundreds and hundreds of PhDs would earn their psychology degrees from G. Stanley Hall, and then they would go into educational psychology, and they would then implement those stimulus response programs. So the stimulus response is basically your classical conditioning. Later, they sort of played with the reward and punishment mechanisms with key figures like E.L. Thorndike, and that's who Robert Glaser was given an award in honor of. Thorndike was hired by James McKean Cattell. Both of these gentlemen at Columbia University. Cattell himself also studied under Wundt. So Thorndike, in that tradition of Wundtian stimulus response psychology, he develops this thing called behaviorism, and he did what was called puzzle box experiments. And these are like the early experiments where they would take pigeons and rats, put them in mazes, and try to get them to perform particular behaviors. So based on those puzzle box experiments with the punishment reward system, B.F. Skinner would then create a system called operant conditioning. It's all basically the same thing. It's all stimulus response. The only difference is the punishment reward cycle. B.F. Skinner added four quadrants, or he added two more quadrants, totaling four. And so the positive and negative punishment, positive and negative reward. And then he created these analog teaching machines, which you can see pictures of them at the Smithsonian Institute. They're like, they're analog, so they're like boxes with gears and wheels and a roll of tape. And basically what you would do is, in the classical sense of the word, use Pavlov's dog as an example, right? So you provide some type of environmental stimuli like food. The dog has a response, which is salivation. You can associate the environmental stimuli with another artificial stimuli. So ring the bell. The dog associates the bell with the food. Eventually, you can just ring the bell. The dog salivate. So you take this principle and you just change the environmental stimuli to learning stimuli, which would be various lessons. So question, answer, multiple choice, matching, short answer. You put it on a reel of tape. You can only turn the tape in one direction. I always like to use the analogy, kind of like the old Viewmasters we used to have when we were kids, where you put this disc inside these goggles and it's got all these Disney pictures, and then you pull this button, and then every time you push it, the wheel turns. So you do the same thing, but instead of the Disney pictures, you've got those learning stimuli. And so the student either punches in, like on an IBM punch card, the multiple choice box or the matching box,
you could also scribe on a roll of tape, maybe a short answer. Again, it only goes in one direction, so you can't go back and redo the answer. And based on how effectively the student answers the questions, how quickly and how effectively, the student would either be advanced to more challenging, maybe even advanced learning modules, or they might be remediated. And then he even had some of these machines that were designed to dispense chocolate if you got a right answer. So he included the reward system in there. And the company that developed a lot of his prototypical machines was IBM. And in this NEA Teaching Machines and Program Instruction document, it has contains articles from B.F. Skinner. There's a whole section on it. There's also a section of articles from various departments of the military. This book was published in collaboration with the Navy, the Air Force, and the U.S. Army's Human Resources Research Office. So they basically got all this stuff put together in the 60s. And then we move forward to the modern adaptive learning software. You just change the analog system, wheel of tape, gears, and things like that. And you just make it digital. And you put it on a window. You can click with a mouse instead of turning the wheel. I guess it could be a little more interactive because, you know, they might have video games you could play for gamified learning. They might have some other audiovisual materials, short documentaries and things like that. And perhaps the algorithms can be a little more complex, but the outcome is the same, that based on how the student responds to the learning stimuli on the module, that student is going to be funneled into either advanced courses or remediated courses. And all these are going to be geared toward what they call career pathways. And so basically funneling you into a specific company and basically replacing academics with workforce training. So if we jump to the present, IBM itself has its artificial intelligence bot known as Watson, which, by the way, is named after Thomas J. Watson. He's the guy who famously partnered with Hitler to facilitate the data in the concentration camps, which wasn't just, you know, how many prisoners they had, but a lot of that was eugenics data as well. So we move forward in time here, and IBM, in addition to partnering with the NEA through Davy to develop these prototypical teaching machines, today, now it has its own AI adaptive learning software, which partners with Sesame Street Workshop and also the Pearson Corporation, which is the largest education corporation in the world. We could also talk about the roots of IBM in partnership with the AFT. And that pretty much goes back to Albert Schenker, one of the first presidents of the American Federation of Teachers. And he actually was a member of the Trilateral Commission. And a funny story about that, the way I even found that out was my friend, Charlotte Thompson Iserby, wrote The Deliberate Dumbing Down of America, wrote the foreword to my book. I went and spent 30 days with her. She let me go through all her files. Her friend, Ann Herzer, who was highly active in the Arizona Federation of Teachers, she had put in a resolution to ban the Skinner method in the 80s. And she would go to these conferences, and she told me that one day she went to a conference and she was able to talk to Schenker face to face. And she basically asked Schenker why the AFT only supported Democratic candidates. And he immediately, I guess he was thinking that he would score some, you know, like right of center points with her by saying this. He says, "Oh, but I am a member of the Trilateral Commission." And she said he was shaking her hand profusely and she wouldn't let it go. He was really nervous. And she said she basically had to yank it away. And I asked her, I said, you know, can you document that? And she says, "No, but you can quote me." So I, you know, was willing to do that, but I wanted to find a document, right? So I didn't have to use an anecdote. And I found a document, a speech he gave in the early 80s, where he admits that he was at a meeting of the Trilateral Commission with, quote, bankers and the head of IBM. Okay, and then you can also fast forward to the present, and there's a guy's name is Stan Litto, and he was the former president of the IBM Foundation. He has set up a program called PTEC. It's a charter school program, and it partners with this IBM platform called Open PTEC. They recently changed the name to Skills Build, and it provides high-tech training for AI, cloud, cybersecurity, quantum, data science, blockchain, all that type of stuff. But he was this project was recently promoted by the current president of the American Federation of Teachers, and that is Randy Weingarten. And actually, in this little video where they're promoting this former IBM Foundation president's project, she says that she'd known him for, quote, decades. Okay, so beginning at least within the 1960s and then moving all the way up to the present, both unions have had direct partnership with IBM, which has been at the core of developing these teaching machines that are now the adaptive learning software that is used through companies like Dreambox. There's Brightspace Leap. There's Clever, which is funded by Bilderberger Peter Thiel. There's something called Alex, A-L-E-K-S. McGraw-Hill has a Connect app. All of these are adaptive learning software that use that same Skinnerian style of stimulus response conditioning. And actually, I should mention that, you know, you can just look that up. It's explicitly, it's always tied to this Skinner's operant conditioning, but it's also tied to, they have a lot in common with the behavioral advertising algorithms that are used for personalized ads, right? And they often use the example of Netflix or Amazon behavioral advertising algorithms that are basically using the same type of data mechanism, which ties into the workforce training, right? Because, you know, the idea of advertising for, you know, commercial consumption, and you can just sort of flip it around and advertise it for commercial production, right? And then it's sort of a feedback loop.
You, in discussing that, touched on a lot of different, I guess, ed tech technologies, right? So I think it might be helpful for people to maybe know if you could maybe touch on, you obviously mentioned several, but what are some of the, you know, technologies that these groups, big tech, these teachers unions, IBM, and what have you, looking to implement widely at the current time? And, you know, if you could give maybe a summary of some of their risk and who benefits.
The schools where I'm at currently, the main platforms that they're using are what are called the learning management systems. And so this is like this dashboard that you're going to use that's got all these different learning modules on it. So there's Desire to Learn, there's Blackboard, and then there's others as well. Canvas is another one. The schools where I teach, I have to use D2L, and I have to use Canvas. Now, they don't necessarily come hooked up with the adaptive learning software, but like in the D2L platform that I use, there's a little link for Brightspace Leap, and that's the adaptive learning algorithm with different adaptive learning functions as well. But that would be the one that would data mine the students' psychometrics, right? Their cognitive behavioral algorithms. And the dangers in that, well, there's twofold. Okay, so one is basically what they're really looking for is what they call performance-based algorithms. So they're looking to see what the student can do more than what the student knows. In other words, they're looking to see that the student can comply with directives, whether they be learning directives or workforce directives, rather than what they conceptually know and have a higher understanding of. So it's basically dumbing down learning to simply can you perform the workforce, they call them competencies that a particular company might want. Okay, so they're not teaching you like they're teaching you what to think, not how to think. The other danger involved with that is that These are basically, these dashboards are permanent. And so the adaptive learning software is not just looking at how well you perform on the immediate module in front of you. It's aggregating your performance over time. So let's say, you know, you're a student. Like, I remember when I was in school and I would get bored with, like, standardized tests and stuff. And, like, especially if it was multiple choice, I just start spelling things. Like, you know, bad, dad, cab, abacadabra. You know, just get this done, right? Especially the state standardized test, because I knew it didn't have an effect on my grade. So let's say the student is just wants to get this module done, right? They're bored with the module, and they're doing that, you know, repeatedly for a week or two. And the teacher says, "Hey, you know, you really need to, you know, get up to bar here, or you're not going to pass." Now the student actually starts trying, and they do really good on the next module. Well, they're not going to immediately advance you to the higher learning, you know, or to the more advanced curriculum. They're going to go, "Well, you did really good on that one, little Johnny, but, you know, you've been messing up for 2 weeks straight. So, you know, this probably is just a fluke. We're going to go ahead and remediate you a couple more times just to make sure." Right. And then let's say you go from one school to the next. You know, and later we'll talk about how this can be integrated on the blockchain system through the some of the vaccine passports and some other blockchain platforms. But let's say you go to a new class or a new teacher, right? And but all the teachers are using the same dashboard, and right, they're all using the same adaptive learning app, which again, right, it has your history on it. So, you know, I know that when I was learning. You know, when I was in school and then wasn't the best student, and, you know, I was kind of a goofball. But there were certain teachers that they would nip that in the bud early on. Like day one, I would try to be a class clown, and they basically let me know that wasn't going to fly there, and I would perform perfectly fine there. Right. And they would say, I say stuff to the other teachers, like, "I don't have a problem with him. Like, you know, I don't know what you're doing in your classroom, but he learns just fine in my class." Well, If you were to go, if you're the student and you go to another class where maybe a teacher has a different approach, and maybe they see more potential in you, and they're able to get that out of you, they still have to work with the dashboard. They still have to they're largely not in control of what modules the adaptive learning is going to give you. So even though they might see the potential in you, and even though they might have an idea of a different way to get you to learn, you know, or to perform better, you're going to be stuck having to stay in whatever career pathway or whatever algorithm that the adaptive learning has on it. So one is basically it's just funneling students into the workforce system, making them, you know, little workforce drones. But then the other one is that data is going to follow them and track them everywhere. And there's no way to just, you know, come to the light one day and just do a 180 and then basically start from fresh.
Right. So I think it's important that we talk a little bit about some of the different aspects of this here. One thing I want to bring up first, well, there's two things I want to bring up based on what you just said. One is I was actually just a day or two ago, this article came out about the 7 tech trends shaping smart education in the post-COVID era, what have you. And one of the things there, it's number 3, is performance analysis systems, which is basically what you touched on there about, you know, what measuring and gauging students based on what they can do. And I do want to point out, and I'm sure you're aware of this too, that there are actually some ed tech companies that are trying to take this to the next level. Like, I'm sure some people may have seen these like headsets. I think it's a Harvard company and like a Chinese tech firm. They're piloting them a lot in China right now. And they're supposed to measure like attentiveness and things like that. And they gauge like a child's attentiveness over the course of the day. They're being used on like elementary school kids over there. And, you know, it looks like based on where they're trying to take this, that it's going to be a lot farther than even what you described, that the plans here are to really take these efforts to use technology to shape children into, you know, good little drones or whatever, however you want to frame it. It's all very dystopian. It is really coming. We're moving into a level even beyond what we are seeing right now, at least in the U.S. and in countries that sort of follow the U.S. model. But in terms of like data mining and AI, I think it's worth keeping in mind here. I've talked about this in my work on and off over the past, 2 years or so, that the fourth industrial revolution and all of that, the data is the new oil era. The oligarch class of this fourth industrial revolution is going to be those who mine and or control the most data in the world. And so I think a lot of these different entities recognize that and see education as the greatest opportunity, specifically the youths, right? Whether in education or maybe, online gaming that kids use and stuff like that, sort of see that as the big opportunity to secure their economic position in the world to come, if you want to call it that. So there's like a lot of really sinister motivations. I would call them sinister, but it's, I guess it's economic at the end of the day, but that are seeking to use kids and the education system more broadly as a way to harvest data. And of course, one of the things that data is being used to is to feed artificial intelligence algorithms that, if you're familiar with my work on Welcome Leap earlier this year, there's a major effort to basically make AI that develops like a child's brain. So what better way to make AI algorithms that do that by, mining data from the brains of actual children to do that. And that seems like where a lot of these ed tech trends are heading. And of course, they've been working on selling this stuff to the public for years. I'm like turning 32 soon. So I'm like, guess I'm not that old. But when I was in like middle and high school, they started with the whole like smart board thing. It's like a big controversy in the school district I was in, because the head of the school board had like some under the table deal with the company that made them, typical. but they were really clumsy, and they got in the way of teachers that were used to using whiteboards and could teach effectively with whiteboards. They were forcing them to like learn this clumsy new system. They were installed over the whiteboard in such a way that you couldn't like lift it up to use the whiteboard underneath. You were like obligated to use this clunky thing. And this was like, a while ago. I'm sure the smart boards of today are probably, maybe slightly more functional. Maybe not. I mean, who really knows? Beyond people that have to use them every day, like, I don't really know. That stuff sort of can seem kind of innocent at first. And like, I guess, it helps to see the big picture, to really understand what all of this stuff is a part of. And I think a lot of the value in your work is that you go really far back to the origins of all these trends and these different conflicts of interest and shaping what we're seeing today. And not only do you do that, you also look forward. You really provide the big picture the way it needs to be shown, from 40 plus years ago to where they're trying to take this by 2050. So I'd like to talk about a little bit about that stuff first. I don't know if you'd either like to start with what comes, what they plan to come in the decades to come, or, how this sort of formulated over, a couple decades ago or several decades ago. But I think both are important parts of this discussion.
So you mentioned one thing, so the performance-based algorithm. So the current Secretary of Education, Miguel Cardona, there's this push to change, they want to stall or entirely get rid of the standardized tests that they use to basically measure where students are at for the year, right? And so the argument is that because of COVID, because of the lockdowns, no one's had a normal school year, right? And so how can we hold them to the same standards, the same tests, when they haven't had the same schooling experience, right? And so one of the ways to there's always been associated with the community schooling movement, and Cardona is affiliated with, or he was endorsed by Linda Darling Hammond, who is one of the pioneers in community schools, goes back to a guy named Ted Sizer and then the Good Lad Study. But something that was always integral to this community schooling model was something called performance-based assessments. And performance-based assessments, you know, back in the day before they had the algorithms, they would pitch stuff like, oh, it'd be like, you know, maybe like a presentation at the end of the year, an oral exam, or like a portfolio of all the things you've done this year. But now that we have these algorithms, right, we could basically just, we don't even need standardized tests. Let's just aggregate all the algorithms together at the end of the year and give this student, you know, some sort of an overall learning score for the semester or the school year. And then that can replace, that can just replace the old standardized tests that we would take. And, you know, that some of those algorithms could be what are also known as not just the cognitive behavioral algorithms from the adaptive learning software, but then there's also something called social emotional learning. And when you mentioned the headband, that's a company called BrainCo. And yes, it's some of the people that developed it are out of Harvard, but the actual manufacturing is in partnership with a Chinese state-owned electronics company. It's one of the largest state-owned companies in China. And you can actually see there's a Wall Street Journal piece that shows the students wearing those headbands. And it also shows that those social emotional algorithms. So the headband is measuring, like, is the student paying attention? Does he like what he or she sees on the whiteboard? Are they engaged enough? Right. These are all these different affective algorithms, right? And it goes on the social credit dashboard. And not only can the teacher see in real time, you know, which students are, you know, resisting or you know, don't like the have a negative affect in response to the learning stimuli, or which students are, you know, daydreaming. It also goes to mom and dad, right? They have a little app for it. So a teacher might be like, hey, you know, saw your attention algorithms were off today, and then you go home. And mom and dad, right? Like, hey, we saw your attention algorithms were off today. And so, you know, it ties in not just to the big data social credit system, but, you know, the sort of the snitch society that comes with that, where everybody sort of reinforces the social credit by monitoring each other. And so you mentioned that all these algorithms are basically designed to build artificial intelligence. And so, you know, if you're going to build not just what they call dumb AI, which could be a SEL algorithm, socio-emotional learning algorithm, or a cognitive behavior algorithm, which has a very narrow data mining function, if you can aggregate those two, the effective data and the thinking data together, so, you know, emotional data and thinking data together, right, now you're moving in the direction of what they call general AI, which is artificial intelligence that can mimic the thinking of a human being. And so, you know, they pitch it as like these algorithms are teaching you, they're helping you learn, but the algorithms learn way faster than you do. So really what's happening is you're teaching AI. And, you know, I think that one of the one of the advantages of using, because you could get similar algorithms, you know, by data mining, you know, workers at work in terms of how efficiently they perform on their telework modules and things like that. But if you data mine different students at different phases in their development, what you can do is you can sort of use as like a spreadsheet for machine learning. You can take the different age groups and you can fit them into some of the developmental psychological stages developed by like Erikson and Piaget. And then you could, by looking at how the algorithms change from each group to the next, right, you could aggregate all of that together, and you could not just come up with an algorithm that mimics a 7-year-old or a 15-year-old, right, in terms of this humanoid AI, you could teach the AI to learn from itself, right? To recursively, with machine learning, data mine its own current state and advance on it based on how the algorithms progress from the different stages in the children's developmental psychology. And you know, all of this eventually plugs into not just the social credit system, but you know, ultimately, when we go from the cognitive behavioral algorithms that are on a screen, then we go to wearables, right? Like, so we mentioned the BrainCo headband, but we also have like the Gates Foundation's galvanic skin response monitors and other wearable devices that can get your emotional algorithms. We're a transition. We're one step closer to implantables, right? And so this is all on a progressive trajectory towards transhumanism, where eventually, you know, whether it be brain computer interface like Elon Musk Neuralink, or you know, someone like Ray Kurzweil says, eventually the highest level will be you'll have nanobots inside you, and that would, you know, through your whole nervous system. And eventually we merge with this AI and we become you know, this cyborg species. And you know, people like Kurzweil say they're going to become gods by doing it, but I'm pretty sure that all of the little kiddies and children that are getting data mined are going to just be little like hive ants that you know, plug into the god AI oligarchs.
I just find it so funny that Ray Kurzweil thinks he's going to be a god. He looks like a little troll man. I don't know. When I look
He's
at him, I
trying
just
hard with all
think
those.
of a dwarf.
Yeah, he's taking all those vitamins. He's trying not to die. I don't think he's gonna make it.
Yeah, we'll see. But you know that this whole transhumanist mentality. Well, I think people listening to this probably know that I'm a big critic of that. And a lot of these guys really involved in that space clearly have some sort of dysphoria with their I guess natural form, and think that they can sort of get out of that by merging with machine, and somehow that's going to solve all of humanity's problems. You know, it's just it's intense. Anyway, so in speaking along those lines, though, right? These people essentially worship the singularity, super intelligent AI that they haven't been able to trigger yet. I think they expected to have that by now, and they have not, and that's why they're so keen to data mine the brains of little kids and teenagers and all that in hopes of triggering that. But this is sort of alluded to in a sense in this report that you wrote about a while ago in a report for Unlimited Hangout, the UNESCO 2050 report that sort of talks about AI and virtual reality and all these different technologies as sort of a being implemented in education as sort of a segue for the whole of society into this more than human world, as they call it, and they promote it as having a regenerative, their words, and equalizing effect on education as part of the sales pitch. But I really found that particular report about where UNESCO plans to take education as just jaw-dropping. And as we can get to in a little bit, if we have time for the history bit, you know, UNESCO has essentially been guiding a lot of the ed tech implementation in the US for decades now. So the fact that this is where they plan to take this by 2050, you know, in the next 30-ish years or so, is pretty alarming. So would you mind giving an overview of this UNESCO 2050 report and its vision for education and humanity?
So you're right. It gives like the rhetoric is very Rogerian, and that means like Carl Rogers is this psychologist that basically said, and they adapted his counseling strategies to rhetoric. And in classical rhetoric, you know, you have like a thesis, and then that's your main point, and you have an argument to development, and then you, right, you develop your points throughout the argument, and by the end, you hope to persuade the other person. And Carl Rogers said something like, "Well, no, you don't start with your thesis. Start with what you know the other side values. try to find some area where there's common ground, and then slowly like bring them to your side. So, you know, there is all this rhetoric in there, like, oh, you know, data is dangerous, and you know, big tech is dangerous, but we still got to do it. We just got to do it right in a way that's equitable, and you know, through stakeholder capitalism and you know, public-private partnerships and things like that. They like to use the term commons now. I think they, you know, I think they feel like that doesn't have the same baggage as stakeholder capitalism and public-private partnerships. But you know, it's basically just a spin on the same concept. So, you know, in that document, one of the phrases they call it is learning to become. And so what they foresee is the death of the school. That's a quote. And then they say, which will be replaced by an infinity of devices and approaches strongly supported by digital technology and artificial intelligence, all of which point in the direction of hyper-personalization of learning. In such scenarios, schools are seen as obsolete institutions. Teachers become expendable professionals who could easily be replaced by other forms of monitoring and supervision. And this kind of dovetails with a 2014 UNESCO Intergovernmental Council for the Information for All program. And in this document, they do the Rogerian thing where they're kind of like looking at both sides. And I'll just read this part. It says, scientists are discussing the convergence of nano, bio, and cognitive technologies, the development of which is in turn closely linked to information and communication technologies, and which have an equally powerful potential to influence sociocultural processes. Specialists are predicting even more fundamental changes. By the middle of the 21st century, artificial intelligence will attain the level of natural intellect, and in a number of cases will surpass it. Machine-human hybrids, cyborgs, and humanoid robot androids created on a biological basis will become more and more widespread. Also, becoming even more widespread are the ideas that technological intervention in the human organism, fundamental changes to the nature of man, are describable and beneficial in that they enable a biological evolution which is truly controlled. So that's that learning to become, right? We're taking over evolution through this transhumanist project. And then the quote ends with, some call this worldview transhumanism. Some call it technological fascism. Either way, our future lies more and more in the hands of new engineers, genetic scientists, and programmers. So basically what they're saying is it doesn't matter what you call it. This is what we're doing, right? And they admit that, or you could call it technological fascism, but basically get used to it. And you can tie that, this goes all the way back to the beginning of UNESCO. So Julian Huxley, who was the first director general of UNESCO back when it was created, he's got there's several quotes in UNESCO, its purpose and its philosophy, where he just basically says, yeah, you know, Hitler with his race hygiene, you know, he applied it the wrong way. But we, in order to prevent what he said, the dysgenic degradation, we need to institute a truly scientific eugenics project. Okay. And later in 1956, he writes a book called New Bottles for New Wine, which is, you know, using going back to this wine to be God's thing. That's a play on a biblical scripture. And he basically says in there, this is where he coins the term transhumanism. And what he says is we could still do, you know, eugenics proper in the traditional sense of like biological selection. He says, but actually evolution is really advanced mainly through what he says, he quote, machines and ideas. And so interfacing machines and then plugging in ideas or algorithms into those machines that sort of create this new species, right? And so that's so it's been UNESCO's project since the beginning. And it was, you know, in the 80s with the, in this article I also discussed the UNESCO study 11, and in the 80s they basically started setting up the groundwork for the information technologies, setting up the multinational markets with partnerships like IBM, again, Microsoft and Apple, to sort of get all of the IT disseminated across national borders. But then they were also in that partnership, it was a regional partnership that combined Western capitalist nations with Eastern Bloc communist and socialist nations. And in a precursor document in the early 70s, they basically said, well, the best model for implementing this at the state level is the Eastern Bloc socialist communist model, because the centralized statecraft enables them to, you know, properly manage the technologies. But in order to create a global system, they had to use the multinational technology corporations to standardize or to disseminate the products across those lines. But once they get in there, right, they really, even in the Western capitalist countries, as we're seeing now, right, they eventually wanted to transition to the centralized statecraft, right? And I should also mention that the OECD was involved in this network through a partnership with Assistant Secretary of Education in the U.S. Department of Education, Donald Sinise. And that OECD project was trying to come up with standards like they have for basic electronics, but he wanted to come up with them on an international scale in terms of the courseware. At the very same time, academia was on board with this. They, in several journals, academic journals in particular, Technological Horizons in Education, they were publishing some of the UNESCO Study 11 white papers, alongside advertisements for IBM and Microsoft and Apple products. So what you had was you had national governments, both Western capitalist and Eastern Bloc communist socialists. You had the multinational technology corporations and academia all basically colluding to set up this network. And then you just move 40 years into the future. We have COVID. We issue a lockdown, and now basically the UNESCO policy, you know, it's, as we can see, all across the world, right? Everybody's doing the same thing. It's essentially a global agenda. So they basically snap their fingers, and whatever domestic policies you thought you had get overwritten by this UNESCO project.
It's so wild, especially when you consider what you brought up about Julian Huxley, you know, basically charting the course for UNESCO in this direction, and how he was head of the Eugenics Society and like all this other stuff. I mean, it's just like, it's almost too crazy to believe, but it's fact. You know, it's very easy to document, but it's surreal when you first learn about it. At least in my case, it was. I don't know if you want to talk more, any more about the history, but I'm interested, since you are an education professional, to get your experience with vaccine mandates in schools, and your views on why that's happening in the education, why there's a focus on having that happen in the education system in particular. Of course, we know that there's a big push for it also in healthcare settings, but it's definitely a similar push is taking place in the U.S. within the education system as well. So what are your thoughts?
So I guess I'll start anecdotally. So the mandates, now they're federal, but they came to my state, my home state of Illinois, before Biden did the federal mandates. And at the beginning of it, I'm active. I'm at a couple of different community colleges. I kind of lay lower in some of the schools than others. And then there's one school in particular that I am very active in my union. And in that school, I don't know what the word was in the other is from the administrators at the other school, but at this other particular school, it was told to me that the head of finance was going to make everybody, if you didn't get your vaccine, you had to test. And he was going to make us who are online have to get the test as well, which is obviously has nothing to do with public health. And even in the Illinois governor's executive order, it specifically says that, you know, when it defines public school employees, it has to be somebody that's on campus at least once a week for more than 15 minutes a day, not in close contact with other people. All those things had to fall into place for you to be to fall under the mandate. But this particular administrator wanted to get us to test, and I was ready to leave my job at that point, because they're not getting the jab, And you're not getting my bio data through the tests either. And I'm just not complying with the nonsense at this point. And that's, I'm going to draw my line over here. I've been patient and very generous and very surgical with the pushback that I've given. You know, I've frequently been pressed them on what is your contact tracing policies and things like that during the whole lockdown process. That's why I didn't. That's why I chose to stay online. Obviously, you know, house wins either way, because if I stay online, I'm using all of the technologies that we just talked about, right? But if I got to choose between, you know, taking the jab and, you know, facilitating some data mining for the time being, you know, that seems to be the lesser of two evils for me. But when they asked me, are you comfortable with coming back to class when we're going to reopen in the fall? And I knew that these mandates were coming, but also they could not give me a clear answer on what their contact tracing policy was. Like, was it just, were they going to make us use a bump or an app? Was it just going to be word of mouth? And, you know, I wasn't going to go there, you know, like if I were to go and teach a class and some kid goes and gets a PCR test who's in my class and then tests positive, you know, now what? I and my whole class have to quarantine for 2 weeks. And so we're going to basically play musical chairs between the classroom and the home VR, like, or virtual platform. Like, you know, if I'm going to do that, I'll just stay home the whole time. I'm not going to play this ad hoc game. So I was not, luckily, right, I did not fall under the status where I had to get that the jab. But again, they were going to make us test. And, you know, at other schools, they've done that. There was a report where a student from Rutgers was told he couldn't attend online virtual classes unless he got jabbed or tested. And so, you know, it was, I figured that would probably come down the pipe eventually. I didn't think it would come on the door immediately. But luckily, the folks at that particular union, who you know, most of them are vaccinated, but they basically agreed that, you know, we don't think you should have to take it. Like, we got ours, like, you know, and we certainly don't think you should have to take it if you're not around anybody. So we were able to bargain to get that, to not have the online students, well, teachers, we can only bargain for the teachers. The online teachers have to get the jab, so I, you know, or the testing. So for now, I still have a job for another semester. And I'm not getting a jab or a test, right? And when it comes to that, like I said, I've got friends that do work tree service and construction. I used to do that. I'm happy to go do that again. I'd rather work any other job that I can than get the jab or play the testing game. So why do I think the head of finance even suggested that? Like, right? What would they get out of that? Well, it would cost them more money to begin with, right? Because they're paying for the tests. So why would they pay for something that doesn't have any bearing on public health? Well, it's to get you in the database, right? And in Illinois, there's the state database to register vaccine certificates is called the Verify Vax system or Vax Verify system. And it partners with Experian, which is, right, it's a financial institution, right, a credit reporting agency. And at the same time, in Illinois, in 2018, the General Assembly set up a task force on blockchain automation. And it's got all these interesting infographics in it that show you, like, how they can, like, tokenize, like, your WIC or your SNAP. That's your different forms of social aid for, like, mothers and people who can't afford food and stuff like that. And, like, it was showing how not just, it wouldn't just automate, like, hey, here's your SNAP ticket. It's like, hey, You didn't eat such good food this month. We're going to give you less tokens. Or, hey, you did a good job eating right this month. We're going to go ahead and give you some more tokens. And then it had other stuff for like sustainability and like emergency management. So you also, during that same year, that's when the ID 2020 project was set up, which is this global digital ID project. And they also have are creating a blockchain. It's called the Good Health Pass. It's basically a vaccine passport or a electronic health record. I believe it could facilitate, testing records as well, like the ones that they wanted us to do. And this, ID 2020, that's you got Microsoft, Rockefeller Foundation, MasterCard, and then you got the Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunizations. And at the same time, you've got Illinois Senator Bill Foster. Who was attending ID 2020 conferences, and he was like promoting the vaccine passports and promoting the blockchain system. So I'm adding all that together to suggest that the reason they wanted us to test was to get us in the database that's going to funnel into the Verify Vax, which is going to be managed by a credit agency, which eventually when they get the blockchain vaccine passports in, that will aggregate all that data together, and that will be the social credit ledger. That'll be your social credit system. And your access to the public square and private services is going to be based not just on did you are your jabs up to date, but they'll add all that data that we talked about, the cognitive behavior, the social emotional learning, workforce competency, mental health. They can put criminal background checks on there. They're going to aggregate all that stuff together, and that's going to determine not just access to the public square and private services, but can you get a job? How much does stuff cost? Do you have to pay extra fees? Like, if your health records are low enough, like a pizza costs you $100 because we don't want you to eat that. All kinds of stuff like that. And I should mention that at my school, I did a little video on it on my channel. You can check it on my BitChute or my YouTube. It's called, it has to do with, there's a, as I was able, I'm an adjunct, and I was able to become the adjunct representative for the CARES committee, which oversaw how we were going to spend the money, the CARES money, and most of it was like to get these new technology platforms. And every single time I'm like, hey, what's the privacy? I mean, the proposals were so vague. It was I want to say shameful, but I want to be nice. It was disappointing. How about that? I want to say, hey, can we say something about the efficacy of this product? Can we say something about like the privacy statement? And one project in particular was a company called Platinum Educational Group. Now, this thing facilitates adaptive learning testing, right? So it's got these adaptive learning algorithms, and it puts it in a national database. Well, this company also partners with a company called Corporate Screening. Corporate Screening is a company that specializes in compliance background checks. And if you go on their website, you can see they do everything from criminal background checks, digital I-9s, biometric fingerprinting, workforce competence or compliance records. They have a Verify Students app for right student records. And then they have an Immunitracks digital vaccine platform, right? So this one company is aggregating all of that data together, your learning data, your workforce data, your criminal background data, and your healthcare data. And then they even have another platform that's called, it's a blockchain platform called Self-Sovereign Identity Management. And the graphics they use for it has got these students, they've got these devices in their hands, and the device is beaming a light on their face, and then their face is lit up with a facial recognition algorithm. And then next to them is like a little dashboard with like a little avatar of them, and it's got all these different like graphs and metrics, bar graph, line graph, pie graph, and basically that's the aggregate of all the social credit algorithms on the device that's registering it through the student's biometrics. And I gave them a 20-minute video report. It was very similar to the one I did on my channel, and I showed them even the graphics, this facial recognition graphics. And I am sad to say I was the only person that voted no on that. But that's just another example of why I think why the unions are supporting the vaccine mandates, because just like they wanted to roll back the social distancing to get the data mining technologies in there, they want the mandates to put the blockchain platform in to aggregate all that data into the social credit system, which can be financed through what they call impact investing. Investing, and actually, the CDC itself promotes impact investing for what they call community school projects. The AFT also promotes impact investing, and then a bunch of the AFT's partners implement the impact investment. So basically, these companies can then, through the career pathways, basically give the students like these pay for success loans to, you know, follow these modules into a particular career pathway so that they can basically not just track everything through the social credit algorithms, but like direct where they want you to go through the social credit algorithm.
Wow. You really laid out a lot there. I think people who are familiar with my work will know that there are obviously efforts in the works to create and enact that type of system, not just in the West, but globally. And any sort of crisis that can be used to accelerate that system, or any sort of move that can be used to entrench it, is likely to be tried by the people behind it and the people that, or the stakeholders, that stand to benefit most from this. And I think it's pretty clear that students are a major target of this. I don't remember the exact quote, but I think Stalin is famous for saying something about, you know, you basically get them when they're young, and you know, it's much easier to get them to go along with that type of stuff than when, you know, someone's an adult and has lived, you know, a certain amount of years without that type of either ideology or system or what have you. And I think there is a clear effort here to do that. And I think really this vaccine passport system, which, you know, I think honestly at this point, you know, people know it as vaccine passports right now, but it's really sort of a misnomer in a sense for the system that they want to implement. It's really much more far reaching than vaccines. You know, vaccination records is going to be part of it, but it's really a digital biometric identity that's really your gateway into this data-enabled existence that they want everyone to be forced to be a part of if they want to participate in society, essentially. I don't know if you agree with that, with that view or not, but it seems like to me a lot of the extremes we've seen pursued or the extremes in this particular vaccination campaign, I think one of the things underlying that, you know, I think a lot of people are looking at it also, you know, as a depopulation event, and maybe that's the case. I think time will tell, but I think ultimately from what we can see now anyway, in the immediate, that, you know, a major motive for the aggressiveness of this vaccination campaign and the mandates and all of that is to force people to adopt such a system, and then they'll expand it and normalize it from there. And that definitely seems to be happening on a very broad scale. And, you know, once you have your ability to access places and services dictated by a QR code, they can connect that QR code to anything, essentially. Or add any sort of, require any sort of data be added to that down the line. You know, really, the sky's the limit if we let them advance this.
Yeah, no, 100%. And the reason why I always tie it to the social credit system, which, as you mentioned, is, right, it's been set up in China, but one of the main investors is BlackRock, okay? And Salesforce also partners with the Alibaba.
Fun guys!
Right? Mark Benioff, right? And, the first time I saw the Journeyman TV documentary, it was while I was in the middle of the book, and I was, you know, I hadn't known about it, and I'm just looking at. I used to work for an online tutoring company, and it partnered with. One day, it tells us, "Hey, IBM's Watson's going to partner with you. Like, it's going to like ride shotgun while you do your stuff." And I was like, what? Like this AI thing? And then it clicked with me. I was like, oh, that's why when you had to tutor on that company, there was a very rigid format for the order in which you give feedback. Well, that's for machine learning. If everybody's doing their own thing, the Watson is not going to be able to figure out the patterns. So they want you to put it in these preset categories so that you can train Watson to replace your job. And so that right around that time, and there was other things going on with public-private partnerships over here in Illinois at the time. But when I saw that, and that's when I started, well, hold on. If they're going to be data mining me, and then basically this thing's going to outlearn me, and then it's going to outteach me, and then it's going to replace me, not only will we be automating physical labor, we'll be automating intellectual labor, right? And so then that led me to looking at other, you know, the social emotional learning stuff. And then I ran into the wearables, and then I'm looking at how the laws are allowed to facilitate this in various ways. Through what they call assistive technologies, in particular, a lot of this stuff was pitched for people who had like learning disabilities, right, or emotional disabilities and things like that. Now, you know, they just want to give it to everybody. But I'm looking at all these different pieces in place, and I'm like, so there, all this stuff is going to get put together, and then it's going to all come together in one like centralized system. When I saw the social credit system, I said, that's it. That's what it looks like when you put all of it together. And so 100%, that's what the end game is. And look, at the beginning of the pandemic, I hate that word, at the beginning of the lockdowns, we were a couple weeks behind Italy and China. And I already knew that they had the social credit system in China. So I looked, I said, how are they using the social credit system for contact tracing to manage this? Because I remember they gave us all like, hey, everybody gets free Wi-Fi and free your phones, right? You get unlimited data on your phones. I'm like, well, that's so they can track where we're at for contact tracing. So when I look over in China, they had the QR code system immediately. And I had my students reading about this QR code for the immunity passports from day one, okay? And, you know, having them read about it and say, hey, you know, what do you think about this? Obviously, most people are horrified. You know, not everybody, but a lot of them. And so I said, that's what they're going to implement over here. Eventually, before this is over, they're going to try for two things. They're going to try for mandatory vaccines and the vaccine passports. And then, you know, at the one school, another school I'm at, not the one I mentioned, but a different school, as an adjunct, I bounce around different community colleges. They're showing us the app that they want us to use. It's called Cleared for Work. It's a QR code, and they called it the Magic Green Pass. Just like the Green Pass in, what was it, is in Israel, I believe?
Yeah, it's called that in Israel, and I think the EU, too, is using that name. In Chile, they say Mobility Pass. Because it gives you only slightly more freedom of movement. It's hard
right.
not to laugh.
I think they use freedom pass, the free pass or freedom pass as a colloquialism in the UK at some point too. So, you know, and then the graphics that they showed, they had this video like with this happy music, like, yeah, it's really cool and neat. Like if you've ever seen the, when Microsoft, they had come out with the daily pass system, they were going to use it in LA Unified District a few months back. They probably are using it now. But it was the same, you know, these cartoons and all this happy music. And it, to me, it's horrific to see such like Sesame Street style, like, you know, graphics and propaganda with this authoritarian, draconian, like Orwellian tracking system. And so that, yes, 100%, like that's the bottom line for this. And I would add one other thing though, with like why the vaccines, right? Because I imagine there's other stratagems for getting us to sign on to ubiquitous digital ID. Another one though is the emergence of this thing called precision medicine. It's basically a series.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's all gene-based medicine, right? You're going to tailor your medical treatments to various genetic signatures in your DNA. And there's actually another movement, I write about it in my book, It's called precision education. And they want to, this is a third realm of algorithm. So we had the thinking, cognitive, behavioral, the feeling or emotional, socio-emotional learning. You could just basically tie this to your physiological data, your bio data. And they want to, so before you even enter into any of the data mining software, we're going to look at your DNA. And in particular, we'll look at stuff like, you know, do you have particular cognitive disorders or disabilities? And then also, like, your IQ, right? And so you'll start with, your baseline will start with your, what they call your genetic IQ. And companies like 23andMe have been, you know, if you give them your data and you check that box where you say you can study it, that's one of the things they've been working on. And this is immediately tied back to the eugenics movement, right? IQ tests literally come out of the eugenics movement back with the Simon Binet IQ tests. They were used for what they call the feeble-minded schools in the Vineland School over here in the United States. This is where you get terms like moron, idiot, imbecile. These were like medical, like statistical terms. So you have an average IQ of a 100. That's like the median. And if every 10 points you would go below that, you would be in a different category, like moron, idiot, imbecile. And based on those categories, they would force upon you eugenic sterilization. In the 80s, they tried to basically make a comeback with this stuff through the bell curve. And you got Charles Murray on that, who's been to Bilderberg meetings. And if you just look at the end notes in the bell curve and look at a few areas where there's these long lists, like where the bulk of his sources come from, they come from people that were affiliated with this thing called the Pioneer Fund. You have people like Linda Gottfredson, Arthur Jensen, Felipe J. Rushton, Richard Lynn, James Flynn, all these people, they were essentially eugenic. Some of the people were explicitly eugenic. Like they said stuff like, you know, black people generally have lower IQs. So, you know, either we should, find ways to limit their reproduction. A lot of times they tried to emphasize, like they tried to stay away from like, let's grab them and sterilize them. They'd be like, hey, let's incentivize that they go get a vasectomy. We'll give them like $1,000, right? And like trying to, you know, what they called quote unquote positive eugenics for what was called mental hygiene. So.
Yeah. Well, there's some people like James Watson, who is known for allegedly discovering the structure of DNA. It was most likely actually a woman working in his lab, and then he and Francis Crick took credit for it. But anyway, James Watson was like on BBC, I think, up until like 2008 or 2010, saying exactly that certain ethnic minorities are genetically inferior. And he was still being toasted and praised by top science officials in the U.S., including the top science official in the United States right now, Eric Lander, who toasted James Watson in 2018 and was like, that guy, man, he's awesome. The guy that, you know, most of us most recently remember for saying that people of African descent are genetically inferior. He's great. And, you know, we have him holding the top science post in the Biden administration right now. Which is, you know, supposedly diverse and great and fabulous. This type of mentality is unfortunately, I've tried to show this in my work as much as possible. It's actually very pervasive in these particular elite circles that tend these days to dominate politics. In academia, science and health related agencies of the U.S. I mean, that's why we're having people like Zeke Emanuel being promoted to lead the FDA at some point. And he's totally insane. If you think Eric Lander's bad, just wait until you learn about Zeke Emanuel. It's pretty nuts where we are at this point. And I think education is a really good, microcosm, I guess you could say, to look at these broader agendas, because if we're not willing to stop this, protect like the youth of today, we won't do it for anyone, you know? So I think the more we can expose what's going on here and how our kids are essentially being, used, data mined and like having their brains like harvested. I mean, it sounds like really gross to put it that way, but I mean, that's really essentially what's going on here, you know, and trying to have the kids put in the slavery system first and get them used to it so they live the rest of their lives, you know, being used to this type of, you know, technocratic slavery. You know, I mean, if we won't say no thanks when it comes to the kids, you know, we won't really say it for anyone.
Yeah, and I want to just say this. You know, what actually got me even writing about this type of stuff, you know, a long time ago was, it's embarrassing to say that I got almost all the way through undergrad and never knew what eugenics was. No one taught me in high school. No one taught me in middle school. No one taught me all the way through undergrad. You heard about racial justice all the time, but we didn't talk about the most racist thing in history. And then when I discovered not only that, like it was a real thing, but that, right, American corporations, Rockefeller Foundation, IBM, were literally funding the Nazi eugenic regime through the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute. You had Prescott Bush through Union Banking Corporation, also funding the Nazi regime, IBM processing the concentration camp data. You know, and then I discovered that stuff like the American Eugenic Society, well, that still exists. It's just called the Society for Social Biology. At one point, it was called like biodemography and social biology, but at this point, I think it's just social biology. And then the journal is called Social Biology, which used to be Eugenics Quarterly. You know, the Galton Institute, which was formerly the British Eugenic Society, that was you know, that still exists, and it only changed its name in like the 80s. And but when I saw that, and I saw that these institutions, by the way, you mentioned James Watson, he's at Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory. That's Charles Davenport. Charles Davenport, he had correspondence with people like Fritz Lenz and Bauer over there in at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institutes, right? And wrote books explicitly on eugenics. When I saw that I had gotten all the way through undergrad without them mentioning it, and that the institution still existed, just with different names, what I immediately intuited was that this is the game plan. They want to bring this stuff back, and they want to do it in a sneaky way. They want to rebrand it. They want to change the rhetoric so that we don't see it as the same thing. And you know, that is really the mechanism. You know, we talked a little bit about, you know, like left-right divisions before we started the show today. You know, I think that's the one thing that is not left or right, that is easy to pin down. It's eugenics and it's technocracy. It's social engineering on a massive scale. And so, you know, that is I think that's the key to the whole project, in my opinion.
Right. And, you know, as you've mentioned in your articles and some of my articles earlier this year mentioned it too, a lot of the leaders of the eugenics movement, well, like Julian Huxley is the person that coined the term transhumanism in his book, as you mentioned earlier, head of the British Eugenics Society and then first director general of UNESCO. A lot of these elite circles and different groups overlap considerably. Another important quote I think of Julian Huxley that's worth mentioning here is about eugenics. I think it was like a year or two after the end of World War II about eugenics. He said, "We must make the unthinkable thinkable again." And what better way to do that than, you know, use your hacks in public relations to essentially rebrand what is race sciences, you know, healthcare and all of this stuff that's been going on. You know, in the decades since. Well, John, I think we are coming close to the end of the podcast here in terms of my personal time limitations for today. But is there anything else you'd like to add or discuss that we haven't touched on already? And if not, where can people find your work, find your book, and how can they support you?
Okay, so you can go to my website to find my book and all the other work that I'm doing. Obviously, you can find my most recent articles at Unlimited Hangout. My website, though, is schoolworldorder.info. There's a link to Trine Day there, so you can get the book straight from Trine Day. It's on Amazon as well, but you know, it's better for everybody to not feed the Amazon monster. But, you know, yeah, you did get a sense of, you know, how the book's selling when people buy it off Amazon. But that's where you can get the book. You know, I'm trying to do some more media stuff on, I got a BitChute channel and a YouTube. Go to the BitChute because I'm sure they'll shut down the YouTube eventually, but I'm using it until they do that. And so you can check out some video reports there. If you'd like to otherwise support my research, I've been building a web brain database interactive. It's got all sorts of notes and summaries, including a bunch of rare documents that I gathered from Charlotte Thompson Iserby when I was visiting with her. She had 36 file cabinets full. It literally took me 100 hours just to pull the stuff out and put it in boxes in a relatively organized manner. Like, so I scan up new stuff every week. So if you subscribe to that, it's like it's $5 a month, like 20 cents a day, for a lot of documents that you can't get elsewhere, mapped out in terms of all the connections that we laid out here. You can kind of get a visual sense of how all these different companies and government agencies and oligarchs and technocrats are sort of interconnected. And then you can, like I said, you can get some documents there that you can't get elsewhere. And, you know, and it helps support my research. So that way, you know, I could hopefully, you know, do some more of this type of research and teach maybe a couple less classes as an adjunct. I have to basically do a double load is in comparison to like a tenure track person. So, you know, if I could teach a few less classes, you know, I can pump out some more articles for everybody and do some more of those video reports. So those are the ways that you can support me, find my book, and keep up with everything I'm doing.
All right. Well, great. Thanks for your work and for your time today. Because even though I like to take the time to read long form stuff, I know as someone who produces long form work themselves, a lot of times there are some people that don't really go for that and are more likely to absorb the information when it's an audio or video format. So hopefully this helps people who haven't taken the time to read your great reports on Unlimited Hangout and or your book. You know, gives them some visibility into the great work that you have been doing. With that being said, thanks a lot for coming on. Much appreciated. And I greatly appreciate Unlimited Hangout subscribers. Thank you so much for supporting this podcast, which, like a lot of my other stuff that goes out on Rockfin and other platforms, is paywalled for the first couple days. And then, of course, public and publicly available for free to everyone after the paywall expires, after, you know, those couple days pass. Thanks to everyone who supports my work, because, you know, some of us in this particular line of work have been targeted financially for our content being platformed on Patreon, in my case. But it's been affecting a lot of people. Looks like particularly those that had continued to rely on YouTube, especially recently, have been getting been feeling the squeeze much more than. So thanks to everyone that supports this podcast, and we'll catch you all next time.